All right, so are you ready for this? Today we're diving deep into covenant forms in the Old Testament. You might be thinking, covenant forms sounds a little dry, but trust me on this one. This is a real like biblical detective story, you know? We're going to try to solve the mystery of where this specific form that we see came from, what it looked like, and what it tells us about how people, even God, related to each other way back then. And guess what? We've got a secret weapon for this. Dr. Robert Vinoy's lectures on Deuteronomy. I know he sent those over.
Oh yeah, fascinating stuff. Dr. Benoit, he really gets down into like the details, and you'd be surprised how much these ancient agreements that we see in the Bible, they have in common with these treaties that empires used centuries ago.
I am intrigued. But before we get too lost in the weeds here, I think we got to establish one thing. A lot of scholars agree that there is this recurring pattern, right? Like a specific covenant form that we see throughout the Old Testament.
Yeah, that's right. You see it in Exodus, you know, when God makes the covenant with Israel at Mount Sinai. You see in Joshua when they're renewing that covenant. Even in Samuel, you see it when leadership is changing hands. It's like a blueprint, like a blueprint for how you make this sacred agreement.
Okay, that's fascinating just in itself. But like any good mystery, you know, there's always a debate at the heart of it. So where did this form like actually come from? Was it just something that the Israelites kind of developed within their own religious practices, or was there like something else going on?
Right. So you've got two main camps here. You've got scholars like Gerhard von Rad, who argue for what we call a cultic
The
origin.
cultic origin, okay.
Basically, he thinks that this form emerged from the rituals and traditions of Israelite worship, probably with the Levitical priests playing a big role in preserving it and kind of shaping it over time.
Okay, yeah. That makes sense, especially given how central the covenant is to Israelite religion and their whole way of life. But maybe this is just the detective in me talking, but I feel like it doesn't explain everything, does it? Like, if it was purely a religious thing, how did it even begin? Like, what sparked the use of this specific form?
Yeah, you're on the right track there. That's one of the weaknesses, I guess, of Ayn Rand's theory.
Right.
He doesn't really account for that initial use of the form. It's like describing the rules of a game, but you never actually explain how that game was invented in the first place.
Right, exactly. So what's the alternative then?
Well, this is where Meredith Klein comes in. He comes in and he's got a completely different perspective. He says we need to look outside of Israel. We need to look to the Hittites and their treaties.
Hold on. The Hittites,
Yeah.
like those guys from history class who fought the Egyptians all the time. They had formal treaties.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. They were a major power back then. And their treaty form was basically like, it was like the gold standard for international agreements. It was the thing.
Okay.
And it's pretty incredible when you think about it, like God using this legal framework that was already familiar to everyone in the ancient Near East to establish this relationship with Israel. I mean, it's pretty mind-blowing.
Wow, that's mind-blowing. Okay, so how did these Hittite treaties like actually work? I'm picturing like scrolls and fancy seals and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you're not far off. But before we get to the Hittites, there's another piece of this puzzle that I think helps us understand how these treaties evolved over time. So in 1958, archaeologists uncovered this set of Assyrian treaties in this place called Nimrud. They date back to 672 BC. And they're called the Esarhaddon Vassal Treaties, and they give us this really fascinating glimpse into how these treaty forms changed over time.
Ooh, okay, so a curveball. All right, I'm all ears. What makes these Assyrian treaties so special?
Well, they're incredibly detailed, for one thing. They lay out all sorts of obligations and consequences, leaving no room for misunderstanding.
Yeah.
And the main goal of these treaties, it was to ensure the smooth succession of Esarhaddon's son, Ashurbanipal, to the throne.
High stakes.
Yeah, very high stakes.
So what kind of things did these treaties actually cover?
Oh, you name it. Loyalty oaths, procedures for dealing with rebels, even clauses that forbid anyone from turning Esarhaddon against his son. I mean, they really thought of everything.
Wow. Talk about controlling the narrative. But there's one thing you mentioned earlier that really that really piqued my interest. You said something about cursed similes.
Oh yeah.
I got to admit that sounds pretty intense.
Oh, they were pretty intense. The Assyrians really wanted to make sure that everyone understood the consequences of breaking the treaty.
Hmm.
And they did not shy away from vivid imagery. So for example, one curse states that if you break the oath, you'll be forced to eat the flesh of your own children, just like a starving ewe might eat her own young.
Okay, that's disturbing to say the least, and a far cry from the language that we typically associate with the Promise Covenant.
Right, exactly. And that difference in tone really points to a key distinction between the Hittite and Assyrian approaches. So the Hittites they included something called a historical prologue in their treaties.
Historical prologue. Okay, what is that?
Basically, it's a section that recounts all the good things that the king has done for the vassal in the past. It's like a reminder of all the kindnesses and all the benefits that the vassal has received, and it kind of sets the stage for this sense of obligation and loyalty.
So it's like, hey, remember when I saved you from that enemy invasion? Yeah, well now it's your turn to show your gratitude.
You got it. Yeah, it creates this sense of reciprocity, even if there's still, you know, a clear power imbalance between the king and the vassal.
Right. Makes sense. But you said that the Assyrians kind of skipped this part.
They did. Yeah, they skipped the historical prologue. And that's a really significant difference because it completely changes the tone of the agreement. So instead of appealing to a sense of gratitude and obligation, the Assyrians relied more on brute force and the threat of punishment. It's like they're saying, you know, obey or face the consequences.
Okay. I'm starting to see the contrast here. So the Hittites, at least on the surface, they're trying to like cultivate a relationship based on mutual benefit, and the Assyrians are all about raw power and intimidation.
Right.
And we know God used that Hittite form as inspiration for the covenant with Israel. So the question is, what does that tell us about the kind of relationship that God was establishing with his people?
That is the million-dollar question. And that's exactly what we're going to unpack as we continue our deep dive.
All right, I'm officially hooked. But before we get to the main event, you know, the biblical covenant, I'm curious about something. You mentioned that there's some debate about whether all Hittite treaties had this historical prologue, right? Like maybe it wasn't as essential as we think it was.
That's right. Yeah, there's been some back and forth among scholars on this point. You have one scholar, D.J. McCarthy, who argued that some Hittite treaties lack a historical prologue. And this suggested that it wasn't a necessary part of the form. But then another scholar, Herbert Huffman, he challenged that idea.
Yeah.
And he did a really close analysis of the treaties that McCarthy mentioned. And he found that they actually do have historical prologues, just maybe shorter ones, or maybe they're in a different order than what we might expect.
Okay,
so Huffman's research supports the idea that this historical prologue was a pretty standard part of the Hittite treaty structure.
Exactly.
And that matters because it tells us something about the kind of relationship that the Hittites were trying to establish with their vassals. It wasn't just about brute force. It was at least in part about building a sense of mutual obligation and shared history.
This is getting so interesting. So we've got these two contrasting treaty forms. The Hittite model with its historical prologue, emphasizing this reciprocity. And then we have the Assyrian model, which ditches the prologue and just relies on raw power. And we know that God used that Hittite form as inspiration for the covenant with Israel. So the question is, what does that tell us about the kind of relationship that God was establishing with his people?
That's the question, isn't it? And that's what we're gonna unpack as we continue our deep dive here.
I can't wait.
What's so fascinating is that historical prologue, you know, it wasn't just some formality for the Hittites.
Mm.
It served this crucial purpose.
Mm.
You know, it was there to remind the vassal of all the good things that the king had done for him, you know.
Yeah.
Creating this sense of indebtedness.
Yeah. That's like, hey, I've had your back, you know, now it's your turn to have mine.
Exactly. It was about building like a relationship, even if, you know, one party clearly had more power. And that's what makes the absence of a historical prologue in the Assyrian treaty so so striking. It's just a completely different vibe. It's all about fear and control.
Right, right. It's like, do this or else. You know, there's no attempt at building trust or a sense of shared history.
Yeah, you're right. The Assyrians weren't really interested in subtleties. It was all about projecting strength and dominance.
So if we connect this back to the Bible, what does this tell us about God's covenant with Israel? I mean, is it more like that Hittite approach?
Yeah.
You know, rooted in this reciprocal relationship.
Well, that's the key question, isn't it? If we accept Klein's argument that God intentionally drew on that Hittite treaty form, then it suggests a very different dynamic than what we see in that Assyrian model.
Okay, yeah. I'm starting to see where you're going with this. So how does this play out in the actual text of the Bible then?
Well, let's look at Deuteronomy, for instance. It starts with the historical prologue that recounts, you know, God's liberation of Israel from slavery in Egypt.
Yeah.
And his provision for them in the wilderness. You know, it's like this grand remember when before he lays out, you know, the terms of the covenant.
Right, right. So it's not just this random list of rules. God he's grounding the covenant in this shared history, right?
Yeah.
He's reminding the Israelites of his past faithfulness and love.
Exactly, exactly. It's an appeal to gratitude and a call to live in a way that reflects that gratitude.
Yeah, yeah, that changes everything. It's not about blind obedience to this distant, you know, authoritarian God. It's about participating in this relationship that's built on trust and a shared journey.
Yeah, you're getting it. The covenant is presented as a response to God's prior acts of grace, you know, mm-hmm. not as a set of arbitrary demands from some tyrannical deity.
This is making me rethink how I read those passages. It's not just about following the rules. It's about remembering what God has already done and choosing to live in a way that right. honors that relationship.
That's a powerful insight, and it highlights how the biblical covenant, you know, it stands apart from that Assyrian approach.
Yeah,
which relied purely on fear and coercion.
Yeah, yeah, no kidding. Those Assyrian curse similes are still giving me chills. Speaking of which, why do you think the Assyrians went like so heavy on the graphic imagery? Was it just to scare people into submission?
Well, it was certainly about establishing dominance,
yeah.
and making the consequences of disobedience, you know, crystal clear.
Yeah.
But I think there's also this deeper cultural element at play here. You know, ancient Near Eastern societies, including the Assyrians, they often use vivid imagery to convey profound truths, you know, and to kind of reinforce their belief systems.
So it wasn't just about scaring people. It was about using this powerful imagery to communicate something deeper.
Precisely, precisely. And while, you know, while we might find some of their methods, well, a bit extreme.
Yeah.
It's important to try and understand them, you know, within their own cultural context.
Right, right. It's like trying to understand a completely different language. You know, you need to learn the grammar and the cultural nuances to really grasp what's being said.
Exactly, exactly. And that brings us back to the bigger picture here. You know, by exploring these different treaty forms, the Hittite model with its focus on reciprocity,
yeah.
the Assyrian model with its raw power, and then the biblical covenant, which kind of blends elements of both, we gain this richer understanding of how ancient societies functioned,
yeah.
and how people, you know, even God sought to create these lasting bonds.
Yeah, it's like we're peering through this window into the past, and we're uncovering these intricate systems of relationship building. But here's the thing: why does any of this matter for us today? I mean, these treaties are thousands of years old.
That's a great question, and it's one that we should all be asking ourselves, because even though, you know, the specifics might be different, the core human needs that these treaties addressed are still relevant today. The need for connection, for security, for a sense of belonging. I mean, these are universal desires.
So it's not just ancient history. It's about understanding like the building blocks of human relationships.
Exactly, exactly. And the contrast between the Hittite and Assyrian models, it offers this powerful illustration of the choices that we face in our own relationships.
Yeah, right.
Do we choose to build connections based on mutual respect and reciprocity like the Hittites? Or do we resort to power and manipulation to get what we want, like the Assyrians?
It's a choice we make every day, isn't it? You know, in big ways and small ways, how we treat our families, how we negotiate with colleagues, how we engage in our communities. It all comes down to what kind of relationships we're willing to create.
And the biblical covenant, it offers us another model, a path that goes beyond the limitations of both the Hittite and Assyrian approaches.
Yeah.
It's a model that's rooted in love and grace and faithfulness and invites us to participate in this relationship that transforms us and the world around us.
Wow, that's a powerful thought. It makes me wonder what would it look like if we applied those principles to our own lives? How would our relationships change if we approach them with that same blend of authority and grace?
It's definitely something to think about. You know, perhaps we can find inspiration in these ancient texts.
Yeah.
Not by copying their specific forms, but by embracing those deeper values that they yeah, represent.
It's like using those ancient blueprints to build something new, something better.
Yeah.
Okay, this deep dive has taken us on quite a journey. We've deciphered hidden codes, we've explored the evolution of treaties, and we've discovered some pretty profound truths about the nature of relationships. It's been amazing.
Yeah, and it's not over yet. We've still got some more ground to cover as we continue to explore this fascinating world of covenant forms.
Right. We've laid the groundwork, but now it's time to really delve into the heart of the matter. How does understanding these ancient treaties change how we read and understand the covenant in the Bible? What unique insights do they offer?
Stay tuned, because in the next part of our deep dive, we'll be tackling those very questions.
Okay, so we've explored these Hittite and Assyrian treaties, and we've started to see how they like shed light on the biblical covenant. But I think it's time to kind of bring it all home. I mean, you sent in these sources because you're interested in the Bible, right? So how does all of this actually change the way that we read those covenant passages?
Yeah, that's the heart of it. It's like we've been looking at this familiar painting, you know, but in a whole new light. We've seen the brushstrokes, the techniques, and now we can really appreciate the masterpiece with this fresh perspective.
Right, exactly. So let's focus on that for a minute. What specific details, maybe even in those passages in Deuteronomy that you've been reading, what stands out to you now that you wouldn't have even noticed before?
Well, for me, it's the way Deuteronomy begins. It's just so powerful. It's not just, you know, jumping right into laws and commandments. It starts with this sweeping historical prologue, recounting God's liberation of Israel from Egypt, and all the ways that He cared for them, you know, in the wilderness.
Right, right. It's like God is setting the stage for the covenant. Right. Yeah. He's reminding the Israelites, like, remember all I've done for you. This is who I am. This is the foundation of our relationship.
Exactly, exactly. And that historical prologue, you know, borrowing from that Hittite treaty form, it creates this sense of obligation and gratitude that's totally absent in the Assyrian approach. Right. It just sets a different tone for the whole covenant.
Yeah, it's not about fear and punishment. It's about responding to God's love and faithfulness. It's about, you know, participating in this relationship that's already been established, not just following the rules out of fear.
Yeah, yeah, that's a crucial insight. It completely changes how we understand God's character, you know, and his intentions in making this covenant.
Okay, this is blowing my mind a little bit. So if I'm reading, say, Exodus or Deuteronomy now, I should be like paying attention to how those books are structured, how the covenant is presented, and what that tells me about the kind of relationship that God is building with Israel.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And don't just, you know, skim over those historical prologues. You know, they're not just filler material. They're setting the stage for everything that follows.
This is so cool. It's like this hidden code embedded in the text.
Yeah.
And once you know how to like decipher it, you unlock this whole new layer of meaning.
You got it. It's about reading between the lines, understanding that cultural context, and seeing the Bible with fresh eyes.
Okay, I've got one more question for you before we wrap things up. You've mentioned a few times how the biblical covenant kind of blends elements of both the Hittite and Assyrian approaches. But where do we actually see that Assyrian influence, especially considering how different their approach seems?
Yeah, that's a sharp observation. While the overall tone of the biblical covenant, it definitely leans more towards that Hittite model,
mm-hmm.
you know, of reciprocity and relationship.
Hmm.
We do see echoes of that Assyrian emphasis on the consequences of disobedience.
You mean like the curses?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Remember those vivid, you know, often terrifying curse similes that they talked about. You find similar imagery in the Bible, particularly in Deuteronomy. It's not as graphic, perhaps, but the message is clear. You know, breaking the covenant has serious consequences.
So it's like God is saying, yes, our relationship is built on love and grace, but there are real stakes involved. This covenant is not something to be taken lightly.
Precisely. And that blend of grace and gravity, it's what makes the biblical covenant so unique. It's not just about, you know, warm, fuzzy feelings. It's about a commitment that demands our wholehearted devotion.
I love how this deep dive has taken us from dusty ancient treaties to a deeper understanding of God's relationship with his people. It's amazing how these seemingly unrelated things can connect in such unexpected ways.
Yeah, that's the beauty of digging deeper, isn't it? We uncover these connections and insights that we might never have noticed otherwise.
Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground today. We've explored the evolution of treaty forms. We've cracked the code of covenant structure in the Bible, and hopefully given you, our listener, a new lens through which to view those ancient texts. So what stood out most to you? How will you approach those covenant passages differently now? We'd love to hear your thoughts. Until next time, keep diving deep.